Everyone, I'm Beatty Cohn-Reynolds, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And you know, it's interesting, I say this every single week, that no matter what's been going on in my life in the morning here in actually pretty cold New York City, I hear the music from my show, the intro. And it puts me in an absolutely wonderful, wonderful mood. And I think that all of us, we all need, whether or not it is music or a mantra or a word or something that can really, really catapult us into a very positive, very relaxed, really, really happy place. Well, for those of you who tune in every week to the Ask Beatty Show, and I can hardly believe that we're going on to, it's over 7 years that I've been doing this show on the Progressive Radio Network on a weekly basis. And of course, I love doing the show and I love your comments and I love receiving questions and emails and suggestions from you. And of course, as you all know, I am a psychotherapist and I'm also a sex therapist, and I am the author of the book For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And of course, on today's show, we are going to be spending the majority of the time talking about relationships with two terrific guests that I'm going to be introducing in a short while. I am also a columnist, and I am so excited to tell you that just recently, I am now the advice columnist for Dan's newspapers in the Hamptons. And it's really great. I'm starting to get all kinds of emails and questions from people because, of course, the reality is whether or not you live in the Hamptons or whether or not you live in the inner city, we all go through a lot of ups and downs in our lives and in our relationships. And of course, I'm also a national speaker. As you know, that I've been in national radio and television for a very, very long time. And it's interesting. Every week I say it's over 35 years and I can hardly believe where the time has gone. And for me, it's interesting. You know, I'm sitting in my office in our apartment here on the Upper West Side in New York City. And I was looking at my mother's china. And my mother unfortunately died many, many years ago. And I was thinking that little Beatty, who grew up in Winnipeg, who was under confidence and who was unable to even answer questions when the teacher would pose questions to her in her class, how little Beatty wanted so much to be able to be a speaker. And my dream, of course, was to host radio shows and to be on television. So the real thing is that, you know, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of motivation and a lot of determination to really get to where we want to go. And that's what this show, that is what the Ask Beatty Show is really all about. It is about empowerment. What are the things, and there are so many things that we can do every single day to really improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships, because I think that we all, and I put myself in this category as well, that we all inadvertently, we get caught up, right, in the day-to-day responsibilities of life, and we forget to do many, and for many people, if not most of the things that actually can and do improve the quality of our life and in our relationships. You know, for example, you know, if we're looking at depression in this country, there are approximately 17 million adults in the United States who are suffering from depression. And I've been saying this for years and years to my own patients. I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton, is that we do not need to navigate life struggles on our own. And that the very, very best thing that we can do when we find ourselves just going around and around and around in circles that we don't know what to do, and our lives are just kind of plummeting downwards, that the very best thing that we can do for ourselves is reach out and ask for help. And I think that it's a good thing that there is more and more and more talk now, at least in the United States and also worldwide, about mental health issues. So again, my mantra, and I hope it's going to become your mantra, is that, you know, when issues arise, and they arise for all of us, nobody is immune from the issues and the problems of life. So a good mantra to think about and also to internalize is acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can, with or without help, the issues that are really interfering and getting in the way of our being able to live a joyful and happy life. And, you know, I was looking at the suicide statistics. The suicide statistics tell us that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States for all ages. And I have a number of patients who've had suicidal thoughts, who've made suicidal gestures. And again, if we get to that point in our lives and we are feeling so low, the depression has taken over our existence, again, just think about all we need to do is reach out. I mean, there are suicide hotlines, there are therapists, there are private therapists, there are therapists who, you know, millions of therapists who are now covered by, you know, insurance. So again, we don't need to do this. We don't need to do this on our own. And another statistic that is very concerning for me as a mom, even though my daughter is not a teenager, here we have nearly 1 in 11 girls and approximately 1 in 14 male high school students. When I was growing up in Winnipeg, I mean, either I was blind or Winnipeg in Canada was just a really great, easy place to grow up in. I mean, I don't think there was any such thing as teenage dating violence. So here we have really large numbers of kids are involved in very dysfunctional, very, very violent relationships. So here we have 1 in 8 females and 1 in 26 male high school students report having experienced sexual dating violence in the last year. Another statistic, very worrisome, reported rates of physical dating violence for college students range from 20% to 45%. And 1 in 3 girls in the United States happens to be a victim of physical, emotional, or verbal abuse from a dating partner, which is why we all need to learn, at least what I've learned over the years, the 3 things that we all need to do to never make a mistake in love again. And I talk about this every week, but I think it is worthwhile repeating. If you are ever, if we are ever, if I am ever hoping to have a loving and successful relationship, these are the 3 things that we need to do. Number 1, each of us needs to be in a really good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, and we need to be willing. We need to be willing to deal with what I call our skeletons in the closet and our unfinished business. It may be unfinished business and trauma stemming from our own family of origin, sexual abuse, sexual assault, substance abuse of various different kinds. We need to be okay. And I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was growing up, I used to say, honey, the relationship relationship needs to be the icing on the cake. We need to be the cake. We need to be solid. We need to be functional. And then relationships can add, healthy relationships can add the most wonderful, wonderful thing, of course, to our lives. Number two, what I have found again over the years, whether or not you're rich or poor or black or white or Hispanic or gay or straight or trans or bi, regardless of all the self-help books and the courses and the therapists and the relationship courses and that people are constantly talking about and the television shows, the so-called relationship television shows, what I found is that the majority of people have absolutely no idea whatsoever what the real ingredients are that have to be present if a relationship is going to flourish. So we need to be committed to relationship education. It's serious. There is a learning curve here. And the fact is that we are doing badly in the world of relationships. And of course, we're going to be talking a lot more about that very, very shortly. And three, of course, is my formula. I did research with 450 people in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut areas, and I devised a 10-step formula that teaches us exactly how to assess, who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And my formula, it really does change the way that we look at relationships forever. It educates, it empowers, and above all, it keeps us safe. And that, especially these days, that is the bottom line. Now, there are a lot of other things, of course, that we need to do every single day to keep ourselves mentally and physically healthy. And of course, we're talking about plant-based diets and exercise and having supportive people in your life and eliminating toxins, including toxic people, positive visualization, dancing, listening to music. There's so many wonderful things that we can do every single day to keep ourselves centered. So please take that in. In fact, that is the homework that I give my patients every single day to make sure as they navigate their days that they are doing things that are in their best interest. I'm going to take a very short break and I'm going to be back in 60 seconds. Well, everyone, I'm back. I had to make a decision this morning whether, despite the fact that I had a really bad cold, whether or not I was going to do the show. So I obviously opted to do the show. And well, there may be some coughing and I've got some water and I'm going to do the very best that I can do because I have two absolutely, absolutely terrific guests. One, of course, who I know very, very well, Bill Brennan. Bill, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm so glad that you were able to be here today. And Bill is a freelance historian and a founding member of Asheville's and Western North Carolina's second largest newspaper. He's had hundreds of articles published, as well as three books. And I am so, so excited that you are here with me today. And I also might add that Bill is an amazing tennis player. And even though we went to the US Open together this year, we were unable, unfortunately, and I'm not exactly sure why, get to the tennis courts, but we will definitely do that when you are back in New York, hopefully very, very soon. And Bill's co-author is Lauren Eberron, and Lauren is a millennial licensed marriage and family therapist residing in New York City. And in addition to her clinical work, she's been cited in several well-known publications and digital platforms, including marriage.com, Bravo TV and Shape Magazine. And again, welcome, welcome, Bill and Lauren, and congratulations on your book, Advanced Romance, Liberation from 16 Romantic Rules to Vastly Enhance Your Chances for Life-Changing Love. So let's get into this right now. And I am so eager to hear what some of the 16 more untrue than true rules are. So let's start with you, Bill.
Well, it's great to be here, Beattie. Thank you very much. I got to play tennis yesterday, so at least I'm getting on the court occasionally.
Terrific.
But yeah, the 16, I like to start with rule transformations which bolster monogamies. And one of these that we call the grass is greener misdemeanor.
Love it. So what is the grass is greener misdemeanor?
This rule that states that you'll be happier with someone other than your monogamy partner. The transformation deconstructs the plethora of pressures pestering us to demean the love we do have. They include the media that's endlessly selling soft and hard porn to sell their products, the sex revolution of the 60s, which insisted that if you're attracted to someone, you might as well have sex with them, and evolution, which in parts railroads both men and women to have the most sex partners they can find. This pressure to go to bed with someone, we have another rule we call the excess sex industrial complex. And the evolutionary pressure to reproduce, we call the evolution confusion bruising. So we have all these 16 are these little rhyming things that hopefully people will remember. And as far as the grass is greener misdemeanor, you know, the obvious solution to that is you know your partner, you know your monogamy partner well, and you don't know the person you're interested in well. And so much of this attraction is an illusion, again, bolstered by the media, bolstered by the 60s, bolstered by evolution.
Well, Lauren, I was very, very curious. You are a millennial. So how did you and Bill get together as co-authors? How did that happen? Where did you meet?
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, so Bill happened to reach out to me via email during the beginning of the pandemic, and he had this idea for a book that is called now Advanced Romance. And I felt that Bill's perspective very much aligned with mine in respect to his desire to debunk some otherwise familiar romantic scripts, to better empower people over their mating experiences, which I think we translate in Advanced Romance as we attempt to provide a more rational and flexible way of navigating and relating to romance as an alternative to some of the more, you know, rigid and familiar scripts. Although I'm a millennial and Bill is a part of the boomer generation, I do feel that we share very similar lenses in respect to our approach towards romance.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as you know, as a therapist, and of course, as you both know, I mean, we're doing really, really badly. I mean, I talk about this all the time, that despite all the self-help books and the courses and the coaches and the therapists, I mean, look at these statistics. Every day, women are killed in the United States as a result of domestic violence. 30% of college students report dating abuse. The divorce rate for first marriages, of course, is 48%. The divorce rate for second marriages is 67%. And the divorce rate for third marriages is 73%. So what do the two of you make of this? There's books, there's courses, there's coaches, there's therapists. Bill, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, as part of this is the grass is greener misdemeanor. People are always, you know, not happy with the love they do have. But we have other rules called the wreck the X hex that you know, there is it's expected that relationships discussions should be stormy. That's what Hollywood teaches us. And luckily, you, Beattie, teach us otherwise. Your great book, For Better or Worse Forever, teaches us to learn conflict resolution skills. And it's something we really need to do more these days, because divorce is no longer considered a mortal sin, and women can exist on their own. So to preserve your relationship, you need to have these conflict resolution skills that you teach so well in your book.
Well, thank you. Now, I'm looking at one of your other myths here. I love how you've described these. The hunting by subverting, flirting, funding. What is that?
Well, Lauren, you want to give it a try at that?
Hunting by subverting, flirting, funding.
So this funding basically is suggestive of that flirting with other people is bad for your monogamy, or a sign of, you know, immaturity or frustration in respect to your relationship. And we debunk that basically by saying that platonic relationships that may have a little bit of flirtation in it could also be a great source of empowerment over your autonomy, and therefore beneficial to the monogamy. I think this ties into the importance of ability to have more in-depth conversations with your mate, to talk through these feelings that one may encounter towards another person, an attractive person, while still maintaining, you know, the bounds of agreed upon monogamy, which may include sexual exclusivity, right? Without having to feel shameful or guilty or wrong, or as if we're in the wrong relationship, simply because we may find ourselves, you know, flirting or attracted, to another person. And I think this ties into the stats you provided earlier with depression, or it could, of course, depression, suicidality, dating violence, right? This absence of education or open discussion around such feelings or attractions, and how that can inform our jealousy, and not really knowing how to navigate jealousy because we don't normalize the fact that there is a natural attraction towards people, and that's okay as long as we communicate again what is quote unquote right for your monogamous relationship, and it doesn't contradict that. And maybe we can reduce some of those statistics. We can reduce mental health matters of depression, right, that are often informed by these scripts, by you know, what we call belief systems, right? And how they translate to the unwanted emotional or behavioral consequences that I know I encounter with my clients in my work.
Well, you know, what I've found, and of course, I said this in my intro, I mean, I'm maintaining, and my research has certainly, it's pointed this out over and over again, and nothing has really changed since I did the research in 1998. I mean, I'm still maintaining that people are marrying and hooking up and living with people who they really don't know, because they do not know the real ingredients that go into a successful long-term relationship, you know, unlike what Hollywood maybe would like us to believe, and that they are either unwilling or simply don't know the importance of assessment. And the word assessment is very unsexy and very, very unromantic. And we don't want to think about assessment, even though when you think about it, we assess everything in our lives, our cell phones and our computers and everything, you know, that we're purchasing. We assess, we're going to, you know, consumer reports. And yet when it comes to our relationships, I mean, I feel and I see this, whether or not it's with millennials and in my practice right now, I'm seeing a number of young women, MBA type young women in their mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. And it's the same phenomenon, the same issues, the same problems with a lack of communication and lack of problem solving skills, the same sexual kinds of issues. In fact, I'm seeing, and I'm really wondering what the two of you have found, that sex in America is not going all that well. I see many, many people, young people, old people, people of all ages who rarely, if ever, have sex.
Yeah.
What is your experience, Lauren, as a therapist? What are you seeing in your private practice?
Okay, in terms of frequency of sex or ability to have satisfying sex or safe sex?
All of the above, including abilities to communicate, abilities to problem solve, the issues that your clients are having in the world of relationships and sex.
Yeah, I think to your point, right, where do we get this information from? I think in the westernized education system, it's not really mandated to be present in the education field, rather than just either abstinence or, you know, safe sex practices. But in terms of talking about feelings and desire and normalizing, talking about our body parts and how our feelings towards eroticism shifts over time, and not to feel shameful towards that. Even, you know, I know in my work with couples or individuals alike, I always try and emphasize the need to kind of check in with each other about our shifting likes and desires, and not to assume that just because, you know, something worked well in the beginning, you know, of a relationship, that's the go-to moves throughout the course thereof. Because just like as we as individuals in other realms of our lives, right, we have shifting needs, shifting perspectives. It's not dissimilar in this area of physical touch and desire and so forth. And so, you know, not having a language to refer to in order to best navigate these discussions, I think, is really what complicates sex and intimacy and, yeah, the experience of the we in relationships today. I think that's a big part of it. So I know in my practice, it's a lot of sex education. It's a lot of here's some resources. Here's some, you know, great persons in the field, great books to begin this process. And oftentimes these are people in their, you know, 30s and up that are still not really equipped in identifying how they relate to themselves sexually, how they relate to their mates sexually, not having enough time, supposedly, right, to explore these matters, the sex being put on the back burner. And so, you know, I always say that, you know, it's not a consequence of something else going wrong per se in the relationship. It also, it is a primary reason for the otherwise unwellness of the relationship, because, you know, I believe intimacy enhances empathy, right? And so as we have more intimacy with our mate, we're going to have naturally more empathy, and therefore, you know, for ability to forgive and not nitpick as much and feel closer and feel seen by our partners, and overall just an enhanced experience.
Right. I think that we all have a lot to learn. I mean, there is a big, big learning curve here. And, you know, I was actually hoping that your generation and the younger generation were going to have somewhat of an easier time, not just in the world of sexuality, but in the world of relationships and communication and problem solving. And I'm certainly not seeing that at all. And so, again, you know, I keep talking about the importance of relationship education. And, you know, for years and years, I've been trying to get high schools and colleges to be serious about implementing serious relationship education courses into the curriculum. And for the most part, that has not happened. I'm going to tell you just a quick story, and then Bill, we're going to get back to you. When I lived in Florida, Governor Bush appointed me to the Florida State Commission on Marriage, and it was specifically for the reason that I would be able to implement my Never Make a Mistake in Love Again, you know, based on my book and research into the high schools and into the colleges in the state of Florida. And I remember when he called me, and I am not a Republican, and it was like, gee, is this really, you know, Jeb Bush on the other end of the phone? And so for 2 years, I met with all the major decision makers in the entire state of Florida in social work, in social services, in education, in the areas of domestic violence. And I have to tell you, I was very naive about the whole process. And after 2 years, it was very clear that nobody cared at all. And I remember I was devastated. I thought, how is this possible? People in mental health, people who are supposed to care about relationships, people who, you know, are dealing with young people and with college age students. And there was no desire whatsoever. And I don't know what your experience has been, Lauren, but I think that unless we as a society are really serious in taking some steps when it comes to relationship education, I do not feel optimistic that these horrendous and scary statistics are going to change at all. I mean, do you agree, Bill? I mean,
yes, that's our first romantic rule is the analysis paralysis.
Right.
And the idea is the study of sex and relationships is sort of a pornographic in itself. You know, it's tainted. It's Masters and Johnson and Kinsey were just, you know, dirty old people. They were looking at something they shouldn't look at. But I think that's changing somewhat. And so, yes, we need to study every aspect of it. And a lot of education as you're growing up. But and one of the things we found is, for instance, there's been some great discoveries in evolution. We call it the evolution confusion bruising, in which, you know, evolution wants us to have a happy mate. It in one area, it wants us to have as many sex partners as possible, and others to have a good, stable family life to raise healthy kids who will reproduce themselves. And so, you can, you know, in this part of this education could be that just relax. Evolution is trying its best to find you a healthy mate. Now, you may do it prematurely, as your book points out so well, Beattie. And that can be, you know, because you're goal driven to have sex. Again, we call it the excess sex industrial complex, when a lot of lesser levels of relationship can be just as enjoyable. And now we found that, like Helen Fisher, Dr. Helen Fisher has a book, The Chemistry of Love. It's found that if you are just looking at somebody, lusting at somebody, then you have elevated testosterone and estrogen. That's fairly well known, but that makes you feel good. And then if you're attracted to somebody, let's say you're talking to him a little bit, suddenly we have what you call the dopaminergic chemicals secreted in your body, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. And so you get an actual benefit from just talking to somebody you're attracted to. You don't have to have sex with them. So you get to know them. That is an actual benefit. It's, you know, there's a famous movie When Harry Met Sally, in which they contend that you can't be platonic friends with somebody you're attracted to. But we feel that's completely, you know, mostly wrong. And in fact, the movie sort of exhibited they had a, you know, 5 to 10 year relationship. They did have one night stand, but they had a good friendship that lasted that long. And it was beneficial to each one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Lauren, let me ask you this. You know, you talk about the hurting by subverting, flirting, fundy. I mean, How would you feel if you were, and I'm going to ask you the same question, Bill, if you were in a serious relationship, emotional and sexual relationship with someone, and your partner enjoyed going out and flirting with different people? I mean, how would that make you feel? I would be not happy at all if Jim, my husband, were to be going out and flirting with a number of different women.
Well, I think the thing is, who's to say that they're not, right? And does that have to be harmful to our connection, our structure, our foundation, right? If it's simply that, if it's simply what Bill said in terms of it was a feel good and innocent one with no other goal as to, you know, go home together, as to have a otherwise more sexual encounter with them rather than just feeling a little bit more good about themselves. So it doesn't have to be just simply sexual attraction based, right? So let's just say as an individual, you have these passions, right? Tennis, for example, that the two of you share. Right. And let's just say your partner does it. And you happen to encounter someone of the opposite sex who right. also shares that passion. Right. Does that have to be, you know, something that is an absolute no in terms of pursuing, you know, sharing that passion with that person who happens to be of the opposite sex and may be attractive, and I don't just mean physically attractive. You may find that attraction towards that person is based off of that shared interest that you have. And that really builds up, that testosterone, that dopamine that Bill was referring to. So again, it's not so black and white. And I think this ties back into communicating, right? Communicating, like, what is, and we talk about this in advanced romance, right? Like, what is going against one's monogamy? Is it, the batting of an eyelash towards a colleague? Is it sitting down for coffee? Is it phone conversations? And there's no, I think what I really want to highlight here is we don't lead with this construct of should, right? We're not giving any rigid approach here. We're giving an alternative approach here, a different way of relating to otherwise familiar scripts, a different way of relating to feelings one may encounter so that we can reduce some of those unwanted, you know, emotions such as anxiety or depression or guilt or shame, or am I with the wrong person because, you know, this person who shares this passion for tennis, I'm finding myself attracted to them. Does that mean that my, you know, lifelong partner or my spouse is the wrong quote unquote one? Or is it okay? You know, is it something I can explore with also being mindful again of the boundaries of my subjective monogamy?
I think that's the key. You took the word right out of my mouth, Lauren. It is being clear about what the boundaries are. And I believe that in a respectful monogamous, you know, relationship that one ought not to cross over those boundaries because we're asking for a lot of trouble.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
You know, so that there's clarity. I mean, one can, you know, one can laugh, one can play tennis, you know, one can flirt. But I think that people have to be, you know, very, very clear about what is this relationship about? What is my primary relationship about? And to be really mindful of respecting oneself and both relationships and being very, very clear that, yes, we can play tennis, or we can talk about politics, or we can talk about, you know, mental health or sex, but that each of us needs clarity within ourselves about what is this relationship really all about.
Yeah, and that's been one of the big changes in the relationship world is that women now have rights, now can hold jobs, are not economic slaves to their husbands, and are everywhere. In the Middle East, some Middle Eastern countries, women are confined to their houses and behind burqas, and that's the way they deal with this. But in the Western cult countries, and other countries around the world, women have, you know, in the last 50 years, suddenly got many more rights and many more privileges to go places. And so you're having to deal with this flirtation situation that comes up all the time. You know, what do you do when you say you got a law case and you're having to work with this guy that you're attracted to, you know, and if you don't, you lose your job. So you have to know how to do that. And secondly, you know, there's more pressure on marriage now that the extended family is spread out all over the world, all over the country, the sort of the family diaspora, you like to call it. And so that puts more pressure on your marriage to provide all these things. But maybe your partner can't do that. We'll try to change from tennis to, let's say, art appreciation. You know, your partner would prefer to go to a baseball game than to go to the Metropolitan Opera or the Metropolitan Museum. Yeah. And so you can find somebody else who likes to do that. That doesn't challenge your monogamy. And in fact, it might help your monogamy by, you know, making your life feel more interesting, and you bring home that energy to your monogamy.
Exactly. And of course, as Lauren and I are saying, as long as people are very aware and clear about the boundaries and that we do not engage in potentially destructive, self-destructive and self-sabotaging relationship, if in fact we really value our primary relationship. I mean, I'm all about platonic friends and playing tennis and going to a museum. It's just that, you know, certainly in my world, in my clinical world, what I see a lot of is that, you know, people are crossing over that line and getting themselves into a lot of trouble. You know, something else that you both had mentioned, the evolution, confusion, bruising. I mean, we can have great attraction and have, you know, great sizzling sex with somebody, but that's all it is. And I think that people oftentimes confuse, you know, great sex and emotional intimacy. Would you agree? Lauren?
Yes, absolutely. I would agree. And I mean, we talk about this briefly, and I'm going to quote this from Advanced Romance, but I'm not exactly sure off the top of my head where we get this term from. So it's called like new relationship energy, right? And where you discuss about like being cautious in respect to new relationship energy. How that ties into great sex is because, you know, new relationship energy is highly influenced by that biological component, right? The dopamine, the serotonin, the norepinephrine, the quote unquote feeling that we refer to as being in love, the what's right. Displayed on TV, in the media, in the storybooks, that's often encountered in that highly more passionate, let's just describe it, phase of a connection with someone. But that doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, a compatible, you know, partnership, right? Because that's comprised of many more complexities in regards to making something work well, right?
No, exactly. I mean, I hear this all the time. Initially, we connected and the sex was mind-blowing and it was wonderful. And then as the relationship played out, the person oftentimes discovered that, you know, there were a lot of things, important things that were clearly missing, and that you can have great, wonderful sex. Mm-hmm. And that is, in fact, what the relationship is all about. So let's not pretend that it's anything more than just great sizzling sex. And to have that kind of clarity, I think it's a real gift. It's a wonderful thing for people to not confuse the great sex and the, is this a really great relationship?
And that's why one reason we're living in such an exciting time is that, you know, the sky's the limit as to what type of relationship you can have.
Right.
We call another one of our rules is the father knows best, Fundy. And that's sort of referring to the Leave It to Beaver and other, you know, 1950 sitcoms that nuclear family with a mother and father and and two kids, that's your primary support system. But now, as you say, maybe you find that you're having hot sex over here, but you have a much better intellectual and domestic and other aspects with this other person. So you can separate those two. I mean, that's how it's best to have it all in one, for sure, because sex has, you know, a lot of chemicals that go with it. We hadn't even mentioned the cuddle chemicals, oxytocin and vasopressin, which, you know, when you have sex, these chemicals are emitted and it gets you closer and closer to the person. And so that, you know, it's wonderful to have intellectual and sexual interaction. But sometimes that may not be the case for you. So your sexual connection doesn't have to be your primary relationship.
So are both of you, you know, then saying that if you're in a supposed monogamous relationship and sex is an issue, or there just isn't that kind of sexual attraction, that going outside of that primary relationship is something that you both feel is it's okay? Lauren?
No, I don't think that that's where we're angling in advanced romance. I think that we're not saying that, you know, if your sexual relationship within your monogamous relationship isn't going well, pursue such elsewhere, right? Ideally, you know, you have a strong, stable primary relationship. And if you happen to find yourself, I don't know, fantasizing, right, about the attractive colleague, then that doesn't have to reduce.
Absolutely. I agree. I agree completely. That's fantasizing. That's not, you know, acting on.
Exactly.
That's fantasizing. That's masturbating. That may mean watching porn. It hopefully might mean going to somebody like you, Lauren, or myself, and trying to figure out, you know, what do we need to do to put the sizzle in our sex lives. But that's quite different than, or maybe I misunderstood you, Bill. I mean, were you saying, Bill, that look, if your primary relationship is stable in all kinds of wonderful ways, but that the sex is off or non-existent, that it's fine for you to go elsewhere and ideally to have it, you know, both in one relationship. But if it's not, then, you know, you do what you need to do. Is that not what you said?
I did say that, but
yes.
That would be a, you know, an extreme case.
Okay.
The excess sex industrial complex, which is one of our romantic rules, it will head you in that direction. You know, as well as the, we'll just go with that one. And, but you don't have to obey it. And sex doesn't have to be your primary concern. What you're trying to do is get your energies, enough energies to be happy. And sex is this wonderful gift that humanity has, if used correctly, will enhance your happiness quite a bit, even give you a meaning for life. You know, it's one of the inherent meanings of existence is this drive to reproduce and all the things that go with that. So, if having sex outside your monogamy or your primary relationship threatens it, then you certainly don't do that if you value your primary relationship.
No, exactly. And this is where I found it. And I wonder whether you find the same thing, Lauren, that people still have a lot of trouble discussing sex within the relationship, specifically, you know, if there are issues, which is why, you know, for me, the emotional communication and problem solving skills are so primary, whether we're talking about children or where we're going to live, you know, or we're going to talk about sex. But, you know, there was an interesting study, and I cite this oftentimes. It was done at Western Pittsburgh Psychiatric Hospital, and this was a study with 100 happily married or happy are very happily married couples who were, at least on a conscious level, they were not in therapy. They were in a study. And what was, these were couples of varying different ages. 50% of the women had difficulty becoming aroused. An additional 25% of the women had difficulty with orgasm. 15% of these happy or very happily married women could not have orgasms under any circumstances at all. A third of the men had issues with premature ejaculation, and 52% of men of these happy and very happily married relationships, supposedly, had issues with erectile dysfunction. So, and what I'm finding, if this is what's going on in the bedrooms of the happy and very happily married couples, you know, what's going on in the bedrooms of the rest of us? And what I'm seeing, again, you know, regardless of people's ages or stages in life, that sex continues to be an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, what a relative question that you have based off of that study. You know, what is going on in the bedroom of otherwise not so satisfied couples, right? Not so happy reporting couples, if that those are statistics of those that identify as greatly satisfied, right? And I think this ties into earlier conversations about, you know, lack of education, but I also think it ties into what we're talking about here, which is a rigid narrative around sexuality, also including that being solely basing sex on vaginal intercourse and not, right, you know, expanding on what sex can be comprised of. The pressures on males and the lack of awareness of, you know, the female anatomy. I think there's a lot of complex elements at play here. And to what Bill was saying, yeah, I do, of course, sex is a really important thing. We are sexual beings, if that's something that's relative to the individuals that we're referring to. And I want to also highlight that there's different types of relationships, right? So we're talking about heterosexual monogamous relationships and means of tapping into that attraction, quote unquote, to someone else and normalizing that without shaming people, but also while giving an option to be mindful of, you know, the boundaries within that subjective relationship. However, you know, there's different types of quote unquote non-traditional relationship styles, right? Such as consensual non-monogamy, who may agree that it's okay to have more sexually oriented endeavors with folks outside of the relationship. And I think what we can take away from people who identify as being in a non-monogamous relationship is the degree of ongoing and active communication that
exactly
is relevant to such, right?
And honesty.
Absolutely.
I mean, if two people are agreeing that they're going to live in a sexless relationship, I have no problem with that at all.
Yes.
Of course, it's discussed, it's agreed upon, and so that the resolution is a win-win resolution. And the same goes, as you're saying, for people who choose to have non-monogamous relationships. As long as there's agreement, there's no issue.
Exactly.
At least potentially there's,
yeah, there's different
issue, until
issues.
One of the people may fall in love with somebody else, and then we're back having to discuss the pros and cons of non-monogamous relationships. But I want to tell you that I really loved your book. I love the way the chapters. I mean, you know, really interesting, cute. The wreck the X text. I mean, that's great. And sometime we're going to have to get you back and talk about that. The soap opera cop out, the replacement, debasement, debac, the impersonal paradox, the one and only paradox. I love it. I love it. I love it. Listen, I'm hoping that your book is going to do really well. If there's anything that I can do, I hope you're going to let me know. In fact, tomorrow on the Progressive Radio Network website, there is going to be a link to this interview and where people are going to be able to reach you both and will be able to purchase the book. And I want to thank you both for, you know, for coming on the show. I wish we were together in the same room. It would be great to meet you, Lauren. We'll have to find a way to connect. And Bill, let's definitely keep in touch. Jim, my husband, of course, sends his best and love. And again, congratulations. And we'll talk real soon, okay?
Thank you for having us.
Okay, thank you. Well, everybody, that is the book, Advanced Romance, Liberation from 16 Romantic Rules to Vastly Enhance Your Chances for Life-Changing Love. Let's face it, everybody, this love business is always, always complicated. And the authors, Lauren Everon, who again is a millennial licensed marriage and family therapist residing here in New York City with a private practice, and my good friend, Bill Brannion, who is a freelance historian and writer and author and great tennis player. But, you know, in summing all of this up, okay, I go back to my research findings. And again, we need to have our own acts together. We need to be in a good place. We need to feel really good about ourselves, and that the relationship then is a wonderful, wonderful addition to our lives. And, you know, secondarily, the relationship education piece is critical. It's absolutely critical. We have to have clarity for ourselves about what the ingredients really and truly are that make for a long-lasting relationship. And we need to be willing to take the time to play it out, to do a really, really good assessment, to find out who our partner is and who our partner is not. And this assessment, of course, it's my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. It cannot be done in a week. It cannot be done in a month. And I believe it cannot be done in 6 months. In fact, my research found that it takes close to a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. And my own clinical experience and the research found is that this process cannot be fast forwarded. So again, I can hardly believe that this hour has come and gone. I have a lot more questions for our guests, but I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And the first message, of course, is that we need to do everything that we can possibly do to find ways to care for ourselves, to respect ourselves, and to love ourselves, and to do what is in our best interest every single day. And secondarily, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in our lives and in the world to find ways to love each other. So goodbye, everybody, and I will talk with you next week and every week, Monday, live from 3 to 4 p.m. right here on the Ask Beattie Show on the Progressive Radio Network. So have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye, everybody.